grown as we discipline ourselves. Our vision increases with our efforts. Here also, then, is the end of pressure and tension of growing. The individual who is experiencing inwardly does not have to fight negative habits. Whereas otherwise, we must continue to try very hard to keep principles we believe within our own lives, we are not achieving a certain amount of disciplined integration. So all these things make a lot of sense and a lot of problem for us, but I wanted to take them up because I felt that they would add something to this study. In chapter 7, we have a further consideration of the problem of the adept self. The time this book was written, there was very little known about certain phases of man's subconscious structure. And the hero self, the adept self, the teacher self, the guardian self, these were not differentiated parts of the psyche. Yet we know that in ancient times, these differentiations were known and recognized, and therefore that they did play their part in the philosophical and psychological symbolism of alchemy. The adept self certainly represents the teacher within. The adept self represents again the transcendent being and the transcendent nature of man, the over-self. Emerson's oversoul, or the Gnostic Anthropos. This principle means that each person is seeking to reach the source of his own necessary instruction. And this source of instruction lies at the root of that differentiation of consciousness, which he calls himself. To reach this over self, so that, to use the Eastern phrase, the voice of a silence can be heard, means distinctly to create bridges or instruments of interpretation by means of which the higher nature of the person can move smoothly and adequately into objective consciousness. We have become so tremendously involved in the reception of image from exterior sources. We have so learned to think of the sensory perceptions as instruments for the recording of environmental phenomena that we have overlooked what the ancients knew, namely that all sensory perceptions are two-way roads. But just as surely as these perceptions must convey environment into us, so likewise, these roads must be the channels through which the self moves out into its environment. The psychologist today really regards the self as poised between two pressures, the pressure of the world on the outside and the pressure of a sick self on the inside. To him, most of the psychic pressure that we experience is negative. He senses psychic pressure as the cause of sickness, as the cause of delusion, or as breaking through in trance and vision, or in dreams, trying to tell us what is wrong and why it is that we are unable to achieve the integration of functions which we so desperately need. It does not seem to occur to these people that this message from the inside should be essentially a good message, that this should be the source of strength that it is from the inside that all of the healing power of nature flows out into the outer life. That the interior is the source of inspiration and aspiration. That it is the source of holy strength, divine insight, and the courage to do all things well. Because, however, we have neglected this adept self, we are not able to enjoy these advantages. Instead of this, we have aborted the process, so that what we now consider as the inside pouring out is not so at all. What we have done is set up in the psychic area a mirror. And on this mirror, the outside is reflected into the individual and then reflected out again. So that what seems to be coming from the outside is merely that part of objective experience which has filtered in. And we have, therefore, really the outside operating upon us from two polarities, its own natural polarity and its reflected polarity in our own psyche. Because of the pressure of this reflection, because the psyche has become a net which has captured objectivity and has been in many ways contaminated by that which it has captured, the road between the adept self and the centers of awareness in brain-mind function are blocked or are restricted. And the individual who thinks he is moved by pressures from within himself is merely moved by reflection of world pressure, which having reached into him is now coming out again. And because of the direction it is traveling, he gives it an importance which is not its own. He says it comes from the inside. Therefore, it is me. I am speaking. This is my will. This is my purpose. This is my freedom of choice. Therefore, I must live and die for it. He feels this simply because it seems to be coming from within him. But actually, the psychologist is right in assuming that these things that seem to come from within were actually planted in there by artificial means. They are not his real nature or his own personality. They are only his degree of social unadjustment, reflected out again, and burdening his entire psychic life. Locked in this struggle, with his own inner life completely dominated by externals, just as his outer life is, the person is incapable of being a channel for the transmission of any true psychic energy. He cannot know himself, because a veil of not self has now been placed within him as well as on his outer personal consciousness. The only answer to this is to gradually release oneself from this false pulling inward, or else to recognize its true nature and discount it accordingly. Until the confusion caused by the use of the psychic instrument for reflective purposes only, until this confusion is solved, the individual, looking toward the interior of himself, sees nothing with distinctness. He is unaware of the nature of himself. He cannot even be certain when he looks in that he can find a self. And in the subconscious experiences, only certain fragments of emotion or thought seem to rise from the depths of the unknown and float upon the surface of consciousness. Where they come from, what they mean, why they are, he does not know or really have any instrument to discover. All he does know, however, is that while this turmoil exists, the transcendent being is silent. While all these confusions reign, the oracles do not speak. And as man depends actually for his true existence upon the oracles, it is important that they should speak, and he must find some way of causing them to utter their sacred sentences. In this, the adept self, therefore, we have the concept of a true internal being that is not the product merely of the confusion of man's psychological lack of integration. This psychic self is not merely the product of heredity and environment. It is a nature of itself. Science is disconcerted by this because it is not willing to accept the possibility of an immortal principle in man. At least it is loath to accept such a principle. It is deceived and confused by this reflection, which it considers rather rightly to be only cast from the outside. Looking and seeing nothing but this, science decides that man has no interior, that there is nothing more than can be seen. The reason no more can be seen, however, is because the obscuration conceals the fact. The only way in which what is truly there can be known is when man is able to relax away from these false psychic processes. This, again, is one explanation for discipline. These disciplines must clear the psychic field. They must liberate man from the dominance of externals. Buddha is very definite on this point. It sounds like he wants everyone to be an ascetic. Such is not the meaning. What Buddha is trying to tell us is that while man mistakes the world for himself, simply because this world appears to him coming from within himself, as long as this mistake endures, the individual must suffer. And there is no end to the misery of ignorance, so long as man is moved only by ignorance in himself. To cure this must demand, therefore, a certain detachment. A detachment that is not cold, that is not indifferent, but is still sufficient enough to enable the person to free himself from these familiar patterns and habits which he has come to believe to be himself. Therefore, when a man is angry, he says, "I am angry," and he believes it. But it is not actually true, because the "I am" in man is not angry. Another man says, "I'm sick." What he means is his body is sick, or his mind is sick. And as he has no knowledge of himself, except through these instruments, he identifies his own nature with them. By reducing these pressures, however, by gradually relaxing the attachments with objectivity, the person removes the mirror. He takes away this instrument of reflection. He does not toss back everything that the world shows, because for him, the position of the light by which a shadow can be cast has been changed. When the light is on the outside, it casts a shadow upon him. But when the light is on the inside, his own nature is unshadowed. This is no time, the Japanese concept of shadow. For in Japan, which is essentially dominated by Buddhist art principles, shadows are not you, because bodies are shadows. And who wants to have a shadow casting another shadow? It just doesn't mean anything. And Buddhist painter will say, well, actually, you know yourself that the shadow isn't real. It's only the relation of the light to the object. The object does not substantially change. It only appears to change. Well, why make a picture of an illusion? Why not make the picture of the thing as it really is? Or as nearly as we can, without allowing it to be shadowed, or to cast shadows, which are not of its own substance, and for that matter, are of no substance of whatever. But the reflections in the life of man are like these shadows. And we have taken the shadows for substances too long. And it is the purpose of the disciplines of self-development to cause the individual to escape from the shadow-casting formula. He casts no shadow, and he permits no shadow to be cast upon his own soul. And if the light is where it belongs, the light will cast no shadow. And the psychic self is free from this burden of appearances which have no substance or essence. As long as we cater to these impulses which are being reflected out from within us, we continue to strengthen them, become more and more addicted to them, come to accept them as real, and finally build our whole way of life upon them. A way of life that has never produced anything, actually, except misery for mankind. Before the little hour of pleasure, we have taken ages of war and crime and death. He could have had the pleasure without the pain, had he been wiser, but he sought more sincerely for the truth and not the shadow. Now, we also have under consideration this evening another important element of philosophical discipline, and this is the exercise of retrospection. And here again, we are following a Greek formula. For the oldest accounts that we have of the discipline of retrospection are associated with the Institute of Pythagoras at Crotona, a Dorian colony in Italy, where he created his school. Pythagoras believed that it was important to keep a constant circulation of vital energy in the consciousness of man. One way to protect yourself against suffering, mental, emotional, or physical, is to prevent bad habits from being formed. Preventive medicine is always better than curative medicine. And he therefore set up a process for the cleansing of the life through a regular discipline called retrospection. The purpose of retrospection was to do things now, and to reject procrastination, or to prevent a single mistake being multiplied before it is corrected. A person does a thing once, this is no habit. Twice, it is still no habit. Several times, habit begins to appear. A dozen times, and it is a habit. 100 times, and it's incurable. This gradual building of habit mechanisms applies to the mind as well as to the processes of the body. Bad bodily habits are very hard to correct and frequently cause serious health problems. Bad mental and emotional habits are more insidious, but as a consequence are far more dangerous. Now, what are the most common habits with which we might be concerned? probably in our daily living, our most consistently bad habit is thoughtlessness. It seems just too much of an effort was to reason out everything. And a large part of our day is spent in the performance of comparatively mechanical actions. Oh yes, we may have to vitalize them a little, give a tiny bit of libido to them just so that they won't cease entirely. But we do not, for the most part, give even important things sufficient thoughtfulness. We also are born procrastinators. Never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. And never do tomorrow what you can put off till next week. For there's always the possibility, as Bismarck said, that by next week no one will care whether you ever do it or not. And you have saved yourself a considerable amount of effort. Now this works sometimes, but other times it doesn't work at all. And procrastination, generally speaking, pays off very badly. Pythagoras pointed out that everything that we do in life should either be done on purpose or not done at all. This letting things happen, this comparative indifference, which we hope to use later as a justification. In other words, we didn't care much, so we didn't give it much attention. It went badly. Well, it isn't really our fault. If we thought more about it, we could have done something about it. So it goes into infinity. Pythagoras believes that the individual who lives thoughtlessly will die miserably, because he will ultimately develop a habit of sloppy thinking. And for the most part, when we look around us today, this habit has taken over. There has never been a time in the history of man when sloppy thinking was as fashionable as it is today. It has practically dominated the field of intellection. We do not care. We are indifferent. Nothing seems very important. Decisions are procrastinated and delayed and perhaps never made. All of this leads to a gradual weakening of our control of ourselves, and certainly destroys any directive or objective with which we may be concerned. We have therefore developed not only the belittle attitude, but we have now perfected in what we call the go-nowhere attitude. We do not care where we are going. We have a hope that in some mysterious way we will drop into a quiet grave before everything goes to pieces. We are not concerned about the future of ourselves or others. And this collective carelessness, this indifference bred by generations of sloppy thinking, will sometime come to a head. Perhaps destroy our culture at a very vital moment. Pythagoras, therefore, believed that the wise man must always be in control of his processes, of his thoughts, and of his emotions. He must also learn the way that we can all learn, and that is by fact. But all arguments and discussions and diagrams and theories are very secondary when compared to living facts. Now, if we had no living facts, we might have to depend upon theories. But we do have living facts. And our own lives is one of those facts. Well, Pythagoras decided that for his disciples, there should be a discipline. Practice every evening. A practice for a very brief period of man-made time, For in the mysterious dimensions of thought and meditation, time becomes ethereal, as in the case of dreams, but a whole life may unfold in a few moments. About 5, maybe 10 minutes at the most, perhaps even less, of man-made time is sufficient for the individual to go back through his life in a reverse order, from the night to the morning, for his retrospection is limited to one day. It occurs each day and covers in each day that day itself. While every memory is still vivid, while other circumstances have not intervened, or new interests have not shifted our perspective, the purpose is to experience our living as a series of small causes and effects. In daily living, we experience from cause to effect. In retrospection, we reverse this and experience from effect to cause. This philosophical insight is especially valuable because it reminds us that with the lives of those around us, we can only experience from effect to cause. The things that we see around us are all effects to which we must attribute causes, and the causes of which we must discover. And having discovered them, we must evaluate them. But in our own lives, we have this peculiar ability to live the same experience twice, in different arrangements, or in reverse order. So we say to ourselves, this morning I said something that was rather critical and uncalled for. I hurt someone. And this night, looking back over that day, I try to understand why. What caused it? And also, what the effects were. Later in the day, this person to whom I had said the unpleasant words was not friendly, but went away, and I did not see them for the rest of the day. I had hurt them. This hurt and this disappearance of the other person now comes first. We say to ourselves, this person was hurt. Who hurt them? I did. How did I hurt them? And we proceed to unfold in reverse procedure the entire process of what we said. Then we seek to find out why we said it. And we go back perhaps as far as we can in that day. Perhaps the incident arose on a previous day. If so, it should have been covered by the retrospection of that day. And it is enough at this time merely to hitch it to the previous sequence. But out of this procedure of retrospection, we also come to certain decisions or conclusions. Everything that we do that is not as it should be carries with it a certain sense of guilt. Pythagoras did not believe in the vicarious atonement. He did not know of anything of the idea of penance for the forgiveness of sin. All these things were to come long after his day. But Pythagoras did believe that it was within the right of individuals to correct themselves. But when we have done something that we know not to be right, it is our privilege to accept the personal responsibility for that action, to honestly and sincerely regret it, to resolve that we will not repeat it, and to permit our mistake to sink sufficiently into our consciousness so that it shall be a deterrent in the future from similar actions. If we think through the unkind things we say, or even the cruel thoughts we think, if we remember and reconstruct the results of gossip, and whom we have hurt, and how we have hurt them, and try to relive the damage we have done, we are not likely to repeat the occurrence. But if we simply cast it aside and say, well, they'll have to take us as they find us, nothing happens, and the individual is all ready to make the same mistake again. Or if we are willing to say he deserved it and let it go at that, which most people use as an excuse, we can then repeat our error with a good spirit. But if through retrospection we break the whole process down, if we really understand what caused us to have this unpleasant spell of temper, if we would really just face up to it and say, the reason I said what I said is now very obvious to me. I was just small and jealous. I was envious of something. I resented something. I myself have a load of psychic pain, and I'm going to take it out on someone. We think these things through straight and honestly. We gain a tremendous experience lesson. For we can relive our own occurrence, but we cannot relive anyone else's. We can bring back, as from the waste of time, this thing that we have done. We can know why we did it, and how we did it, and what we did. We can see just how wrong it was, or just how foolish it was, or how thoughtless, or how rude or crude. And from just self-censure, not some kind of a picking on ourselves, not a masochistic desire to appear to suffer, but from an honest evaluation, we can place our own lives as we would place the life of a small child whom we were trying to bring up correctly. We would realize what punishment is necessary, what the child needs in the form of correction and understanding, and we can administer it to the child in ourselves, for all weaknesses are signs of childishness. Now, I know definitely that some people who are having a great deal of trouble with themselves would never for one moment dare to perform a retrospection. It would cause their whole house of cards to fall down. Many people physically survive only on the strength of their own toxicity, and this is also true on the psychic level. Individuals live only to nurse their grievances. And if they face the truth and they realize the futility of their lives, they probably would be utterly disturbed. The retrospection discipline, however, as we said, whenever begun, does not go back beyond the day. And whenever the disciple decides to attempt it, he must accept it as it was given to him, according to rules which he must follow. He is not expected to ask why. He is not expected to improve upon the theory, because it has stood the test of ages, and the average beginner is no condition to improve on anything. So he does not go back in his retrospection to all the horrid and lurid things that may have afflicted him for the last 50 years. He begins only with today. And he says to himself as he goes back, this has been a very messy day. I have done many things that certainly were not kind. I have said things that I'm not sure were true. Now I sit down and think about them. I have fallen into very poor semantic habits. I have said to someone, anyone knows that chap's no good. This wasn't true. What I really said was, I don't like this fellow. And I exaggerated in order to give added pressure to my own opinion, or else to protect my own good name, so that others would not think I was unduly suspicious. I merely spoke for everyone else, shifting the responsibility to the unknown. We sit down and think about that for a while. We will not exaggerate so much the next time. Then we can say to ourselves, I have passed judgment upon the work of another man. I said he was no good, that his job was poor, that anybody, including myself, could do it better. Can I do it better? A little thought may cause us to say, I couldn't do it at all if the truth were known. I haven't the slightest idea of how to do it. What I merely was doing was criticizing. I was passing judgment on something I really am not equipped to judge. So little by little, we whittle away this broad veil of generality, of this wall, this network and framework with which we surround things. We just face the simple fact. I didn't feel good. Or I was angry. Or someone else had done something to me and I wanted to hit back. Or I lost my temper. Or the fellow was telling me something so true I hated him for it. These thoughts sober us. And in the quietude of our lives, we can go back over a day and sort of put it together. We can say, is there any pattern in my common faults for this day? Yes, there seems to be. I want to put off things all the time. Half a dozen times during the day, there are decisions I should have made, but I procrastinated them. Why? Was it because I didn't want to hurt someone else's feelings by an unpleasant decision? Or was it because I did not want my feelings to be hurt by their hurt feelings? There's a great difference between these two things. It's like not correcting a child because we don't enjoy the tantrum. What is the motive behind what we have done? Were we afraid? Would it have been to someone else's advantage? Have we done some little minor cheating by this deal? Have there been ulterior motives? Have we hidden valuable knowledge because it might have been used to another person's gain when it was their right to have that knowledge? Just how foolish, selfish, stupid, narrow-minded, and arrogant are we? These are refreshing thoughts. They are not refreshing at the moment, but they have a long-range utility. By degrees, we become honest. And there's no misery in honesty. And there's something very private about retrospection. You don't have to advertise it. You do not have to tell other people all your faults. You can modestly keep them to yourself. But you can also valiantly do something about them. Instead of confessing to someone, you can show that you understand by changing your ways in the future. Then there are all kinds of imponderables that move in upon us. Are we doing all that we can do in the society to which we belong? Do we think we can do things we can't do? Are we going out meddling in other people's affairs, not because we really know what we are doing, but because we like to regard ourselves important and hope others will do the same? Are we simply extroverting at the expense of society? Or are we neglecting the common and natural duties of life? Are we neglecting our families simply because we like to do certain things and the heck with them? What are the motives behind all these things? And by degrees, day by day, we can take ourselves to pieces and later put ourselves together again in a pattern closer to our heart's desire. We can become completely analytical, but never should we exaggerate. And Pythagoras pointed out, never should we sentimentalize. When we come upon some particularly unpleasant little incident of mayhem that we have committed somewhere along the line, we could break down and weep. We could say, oh, how horrible I was. This I can never forgive myself for. It was simply terrible. I'll never do it again until next time. We can have great remorse. We can say, this is so terrible a thing that God could never forgive us. We've got to go and hang our heads for the rest of our lives. Pythagoras warned against all these exaggerations and extravagances. Yet the untrained and untutored mind and emotions are subject to such exaggerations. But remember that we are sitting impersonally in judgment. We are like a judge. We are not likely to become greatly involved or to become really nasty to the culprit. The judge will pass sentence as impartially as possible. And unless the offense is particularly horrible, he will seldom have very much to say. The law will have its own way. In this way, also, we have to examine our own nature. Our purpose is to recognize that temperament and disposition and circumstances and incidents are part of life. We are expected to make these mistakes. We are expected to do things badly. We must inevitably commit faults until we take over the conscious administration of our own affairs. Until the day when we outgrow these weaknesses, we must have them. The crime is not in having them. The misfortune is that we must suffer because we have them. And suffer we will until we correct them. So we have no reason to become extravagantly despondent. What we have to do is face the facts as we would face the correction of a small child. To us, the small child's mistake may seem much more trivial than it does to the child, whose whole life may be, to its own thinking, hanging in the balance. Therefore, a simple, direct, factual conclusion, with a thorough remembrance of the lesson. If we get too emotional or too much involved, we may never do anything again for fear that we'll do it wrong. This is not the answer. The answer is to try to measure each day by a code of analysis that is simple, direct, honest, broad and sweeping, yet penetrating. Each day will bring new experiences for which we will not always be prepared. But by retrospection, we also gain a general preparedness. We learn gradually in, say, a year or two of retrospective discipline to make all important decisions more slowly and cautiously. We count 10. We are not quite so certain of things we know nothing about. By degrees, we ask from others and usually obtain a leave of time to consider or investigate or examine things. We do not trust their judgment anymore, but we trust our own a little less and make certain that the facts are with us in these decisions. Gradually, this habit of prudence, beginning in retrospection, takes over at other times. And we become mindful during action of the retrospection of the previous evening. And we will say, look, I'm heading into this same situation again. This is twice. The first time it is anyone's fault. The second time it will be my own. So we gain a little more thoughtfully. We may make the same mistake several times before we correct it entirely, or before we have the courage to make the decisions that would prevent the difficulty from coming. It is not that we have to grow instantly. It is that we are trying sincerely to grow and are gradually taking upon ourselves the direction of our own conduct as a proper responsibility intended by nature. As we lead our own lives, we have better lives. And we gain gradually control of these extremities by which we so misrepresent ourselves. Therefore, the law of retrospection, as it was practiced, this discipline, makes our own lives a textbook. And we are periodically examined on the assignment of the day, or of the week, or of the year. We are supposed to learn from this text and to be able to answer certain reasonable questions. Tomorrow brings the question, for the day itself is the examination in which the previous knowledge is weighed, and we are given an opportunity to apply it to new situations. This simple way of learning passed from the Greeks to several other people, and it has come down to us through many societies and disciplined groups of thinkers. It is regarded as one of the most useful and basic of all philosophical instruments. And if properly practiced, even the most elementary situation will be improved. This practice does not depend upon our education, or our insight, or our philosophical and scholastic attainments. The most simple person can apply it just as wisely and just as well as the most highly intellectual individual. It may be that the person of more restricted activities will have fewer problems, less definition, and will make fewer mistakes. And this is interesting, because when we study the principle of retrospection in action, we find that the cultivated person, the intellectual, is the one who is in trouble the most. Simple people react rather directly. They react from certain clear objectives and from certain basic values in their own nature. Civilized man, with a breadth of learning and a wide diversity of interests, is more easily confused and more quick to seek escape. He is better able to argue in his own defense. And of course, in retrospection, it is like certain of the courts of Europe. The United States and its legal procedure is somewhat different from some of the European countries. In many countries, a person tried for a crime is not permitted to have an attorney. He is his own attorney, and there is no attorney against him. He simply presents his case, and the witnesses present their case, and the judge or jury come to the decision. There is no elaborate legal machinery as we know it. And in those nations, I'm not at all sure that the justice is any less. Perhaps it is greater than we have here, with all our elaborate means of escaping the loopholes in the law. But in any event, the individual of intellectual attainment who is used to talking himself in and out of situations may also try to think himself in and out of his retrospection problem. But the moment he seeks to justify himself, the moment he explains why, other than in terms of fact, the moment he says to himself, well, I guess I wasn't feeling so good that day, he begins to compromise his principles. Things are so or not so. Retrospection merely clears the confusion that surrounds him. Unless it is honestly practiced, it is of no value whatsoever. And it cannot be honestly practiced if the individual practicing it is full of self-sympathy or is belligerently resolved to continue to assume that they are right and someone else is wrong. Everything must be upon value only. I worked with people in connection with this type of discipline for many years, and it is notable how few persons base their antagonism and their unhappiness upon facts. Under analysis, it is not fact but temperament and disposition that press us on to unreasonable action. As soon as we realize this in retrospect, we are rescued from this pressure. We begin to think quietly and orderly, and we find that we like people better than we knew, or that people have virtues and values which we have overlooked, and that one of the reasons why other people seem to be hard to get along with is because we are unwilling to accept these people honestly. We must distort them to fit into some preconception of our own. I think retrospection, if thoroughly practiced, would help most persons out of a psychosis. Unfortunately, if the ailment has reached a disease proportion, the mind is no longer able to function. But for those who are under psychic stress, and who have frustrations and neuroses and inhibitions which could easily turn into serious mental disorder, the retrospection process, if taken immediately, can be used to straighten out persecution complexes, negative fatalism, defeatism, and all this type of psychic pressure. The Greeks were very wise in this. Pythagoras was one of the wisest of the Greeks. He was regarded as speaking with the voice of an oracle, and his wisdom surpassed the wisdom of most men. And he has given us this law, which is good to practice, and which, if well practiced, will help us every day to grow that day by an orderly and consistent process. Well, it looks like it's about time for you to all practice retrospection. So we'll let you go for this week and hope to see you a week from tonight.
Well, no. Maybe it is.